Support comes from the Norton Simon Museum. Celebrate the opening of I Saw It, Francisco de Goya Printmaker, with an evening of live music, art making, live model drawing, tours, and more. Saturday, April 20th from 4 to 6:30 p.m. Info at nortonsimon.org.
You have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes, too, when you donate now at laist.com/sweeps.
Welcome to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC and the KPCC app. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle. Coming up later on the program, an interview with Robin Wright, who makes her feature directorial debut with the new film Land. We'll talk about grief, loss, and recovery, all central themes in the drama. But first, it is a jam-packed week for film, so let's get to it. Joining us to review the new releases are Wade Major, film critic for Cinegods.com, Amy Nicholson, film writer for The New York Times and host of the podcast Unspooled and Zoom, not about the meeting system, and Charles Solomon from Animation Scoop and Animation Magazine. Welcome, everybody.
Hello.
Thank you.
So let's start off with the comedy Coming to America. That's the number two, not two, T-O. Eddie Murphy stars in the sequel to the first Coming to America. It opened in 1988 when Michael Dukakis was running for president, and a movie ticket set you back $3.50. Craig Brewer directs the sequel. So, Amy, was it worth the more than 30-year wait?
Oh, it absolutely was. I really enjoyed this. So we're back in Zamunda, where Eddie Murphy's Prince Akeem is living happily with his American wife that he brought back. They now have three daughters, and they have a big problem, because the issue here is that Zamunda is, as we got glimpses of, this very sexist, patriarchal country where the fact that Eddie doesn't have a son becomes a really big deal, because especially like his father is dying. And now we have this new character, Wesley Snipes, is this like militaristic general who leads the country next door, and he wants revenge on Zamunda because, in a great callback, Wesley Snipes' sister is the princess that Akeem left stranded at the altar. Remember the girl was like jumping on one leg and barking? She's actually like still doing that. So yeah, it's a story where like he has to go and get he finds out he fathered a son back in Queens. He has to bring him back, blah, blah, blah. There's shades of Borat here, like kind of a kinder, gentler Borat. But you also know like everything's going to eventually work out. I don't know. I enjoyed this a lot. I mean, there's a ton of nostalgia, cameos from En Vogue, Salt-N-Pepa. Everybody is back here, which gets a little forced. Like, they can't think of anything for John Amos's character to do. He had the big part in the original as like Lisa's father, who owned the McDowell's franchise. He's just still talking about McDowell's. Despite all that, I had so much fun watching this.
Wade, what about you?
It is so much better and funnier than the original film. Wow. And the difference you have to draw is that the original film was an R-rated comedy made for his fans in the 1980s. This is a PG-13 rated movie for his fans' children and grandchildren. And it's more of a family film. It's more oriented toward heart. It's less about the gags and the makeup, even though there's plenty of that. I give a lot of credit to bringing Kenya Barris from Blackish in to sort of bring a particular kind of comedic touch that I think is much more broad-based, but also a little bit smarter, a little bit more now. I love that it's self-deprecating. I love that Eddie is so comfortable in his skin now that he wants to be more of a dramatic actor in places here. He brings a lot of heart, and he lets other actors sort of carry the comedy. Leslie Jones is phenomenally funny here. Wesley Snipes is hilarious. And it's worth pointing out, too, that this is basically getting the Dolemite team back together recently on Netflix. This is Craig Brewer directed Eddie in Dolemite, and Wesley Snipes was in that. And they bring the same chemistry that they had in that film. It's just really funny, and it's a real delight.
Coming to America stars Eddie Murphy and Arsenio Hall. It's co-written by Kenya Barris, Barry Blaustein, and David Sheffield. The film is rated PG-13. You can see it at the Vineland Drive-In Theater. It's also available on Amazon Prime Video. Next up, Raya and the Last Dragon. Disney's Raya and the Last Dragon is directed by Don Hall and Carlos Lopez Estrada. Charles, you want to get us going?
Well, there was a lot of talk in the animation industry that this was a film that had a trouble of warning, and then they finally turned it around and managed to get it done in spite of COVID. But I don't know that they turned it around quite fully enough, because it plays to me like Moana and the Temple of Doom. This nameless, sort of vaguely South Asian country has been devastated by these evil creatures and their sort of purple static electricity called the Groon, who turned everyone, to almost everyone, to stone. Then they have to get a dragon to somehow help defeat them. The heroine, Raya, talks like a valley girl, as do most of the characters for some reason. And girlfriend, she's a dragon nerd. But she's so busy being a role model and a positive image, and she's not a character. And it just stumbles on and on and on with a lot of things you've seen before. Characters that look like they walked in or sound like they walked in from other Disney movies or other movies. The business of trying to find the pieces of the sacred jewel comes out of Inuyasha, a very popular anime series. So it struck me as much more as a corporate package product than as a film than as a story someone wanted to tell.
Wade, are you agreeing with the discount Mulan Indiana Jones theme here?
A little bit. I watched it with my daughter, who's 8 years old, so I have to defer a little bit to the audience for whom this is intended. I do share most of Charles's reservations, but I think the problem here is that the moments are greater than the sum of the parts. I think it has a lot of great moments, some very touching moments, some wonderful animation, some great performances. It's derivative as can be, as Charles noted. I mean, it pillages everything from Disney films like Frozen and Mulan to even pieces of Mad Max and Indiana Jones. And you know, Awkwafina is a little too overboard here. She's basically kind of doing a variation on Robin Williams' Genie from Aladdin. Too much of an anachronistic character kind of dropped into something that should feel more period and more culturally specific. So all of those things are distractions. But I think to the credit of the film, they don't distract from the moments that actually work. So it's a bit of a frustration. When it's not working, you're exasperated that it's not working. But when it gets on track again, it's very rewarding. So you have to be ready for a little bit of a roller coaster.
Amy, any quick thoughts about it?
Yeah, I think it is very strong, especially at the Mad Max beginning wasteland vibes that it has. There's a darkness here that I think is lacking from a lot of modern day Disney films. And I respect that its message isn't just like, believe yourself. You know, this is a film about trust, about getting burned and then learning to trust again. But then from there, it does turn into a plot that's just like a quest to get all the pieces, which is every single Disney movie lately. And when Awkwafina's dragon shows up, I mean, she's making booty jokes. It feels like it has nothing to do with the tone of what comes before, which was, to me, disappointing because I thought this started very, very, very strong.
Raya and the Last Dragon is written by Adele Lim and Kui Wen. It's showing at the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair and the Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside, and it's streaming on Disney Plus. Next up, Land. It's directed by Robin Wright. This is her feature directorial debut. She stars in the film alongside Damien Bashir. Wade, you want to get us going about Land?
Yeah, I think this film has been getting a little unfairly beat up by some others, too. I think actors tend to get into this kind of conundrum where if they are too ambitious, they get criticized for it. And when they're not ambitious enough, they get criticized for it. I think what Robin Wright has done here is a very controlled character piece that enables her to do what she needs to do as both a director and as an actress. And yes, it's a study of grief. It's a study of survival, of emotional healing. And we've seen this movie in various forms before. Someone who's trying to run away from humanity, run away from civilization, and just sort of isolate themselves in some kind of a survivalist mode where they're in the mountains and just trying to sort of heal and get back in touch with themselves. And that's not enormously new. But to see how accomplished Robin Wright is in doing this, how she executes it, how meticulous her direction is, and how sensitive and nuanced her performance is through these vast nonverbal moments, I think is very, very praiseworthy, and she deserves real kudos for doing this.
Amy?
Yeah, it's a small film with just big vistas, big ambition, and it's centered on, you know, a performance piece that I think she's very, very much up to. Like, you have to watch her face and understand everything underneath it, that, you know, she's basically happy if one of the outcomes of her moving to Wyoming is a slow motion suicide by starvation. And I think that in that, I wasn't deeply moved by this story, but I really did respect its kind of granular day-by-day storytelling as she learns to make it in the wilderness, as she learns lessons from Damien Bashir teaching her to hunt and trap. It feels credible, and I think that alone is a very big accomplishment here.
Land is co-written by Jesse Chatham and Aaron Dignam. It's rated PG-13. It's available on video on demand platforms, and we'll hear from Robin Wright herself a little later in the show. Next, the drama My Salinger Year follows a college graduate who takes a clerical job working for the literary agent of the writer J.D. Salinger, who turns up in another film, Boogie, later in the program. Writer-director Philippe Faladreau adapts the memoir by Joanna Rakoff. Amy?
Yeah, this is just a classic story about, you know, girl with ambition trying to make it in the big city. But it has a lot of heart and a lot of brains, and I really liked it a lot. It's based on the author Joanna Rakoff on her real-life memoir about moving to New York to be an aspiring writer. You know, in this case, she's a poet. And she's played here by Margaret Qualley, who people would remember as being Pussycat in Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. She takes this job at a boutique lit agency in Manhattan, and this is in the 90s. So this agency really prides itself on being, like, the last agency that doesn't use computers in the city. And their main client is J.D. Salinger, and the office calls him Jerry. And so her job, Margaret Qualley's job, is to be his gatekeeper of sorts, to, like, read his fan mail and to type up, like, a couple of template responses that she's allowed to do. And so it's got this metaphor here and about, you know, what an author's words can mean, and also, like, her own creative stifling. You know, she's just typing what she's told in the formats that she's told. But I think Margaret Qualley really pulls off being a good literary nerd. And of course, like, her boss here is strict, and she's played by Sigourney Weaver, so you're automatically getting these working girl vibes, and it feels like it was very much sold as, like, a sweeter Devil Wears Prada, which I guess it is. I mean, it's earnest and it's cuddly, and it doesn't feel especially phony. So I thought this was a pleasure.
Wade, quick thoughts on My Salinger Year?
Yeah, I think it is a little bit like Devil Wears Prada without jokes. I liked it less than Amy. I respect it. I love Margaret Qualley. I love Sigourney Weaver. I think they're great in it. I think the film is very accomplished, but I do think it's always struggling to try to find a story to tell. I think Rakoff's memoir isn't much of a story. It's sort of more a series of events, and to squeeze that into a narrative structure is a little tricky, and I didn't really like how Salinger keeps showing up like Robin Masters on the old Magnum P.I. as this mythical figure that we never quite get a glimpse of. That felt a little bit forced to me.
I thought you were going to say Charlie from Charlie's Angels. My Salinger Year stars Margaret Qualley and Sigourney Weaver. It's out on VOD platforms. You can also catch it at the Vineland Drive-In and the CineLounge Drive-In in Hollywood. We're continuing now with Tom and Jerry. It's an adaptation of the classic Hanna-Barbera cartoon. It's directed by Tim Story and stars Chloe Grace Moretz, Michael Pena, and Ken Jeong. Charles?
Well, Hanna-Barbera's Tom and Jerry were hugely popular 80 years ago, but they depended on a kind of slapstick humor that requires the most razor-sharp timing for it to work. I mean, down to the individual frame can determine, does a gag land? And the artist doing Tom and Jerry can't do it. They've also tried to give them much more of a backstory than the characters had or need. Tom comes to New York to try and be a musician. Jerry is just moving to the city. They immediately start fighting. They run into Chloe Grace Moretz, who has lied her way into a job in a fancy hotel. Jerry wants to live in the hotel. Tom is supposed to get rid of him. It's just embarrassingly bad and ethnically so completely tone deaf. There's a fussy, effete Chinese chef. There are super rich, vulgar East Indians. Tom meets some street cats who can talk in kind of black jive. It just lays there.
Amy, any kinder words from you?
Yeah, I think Charles is the cat and I'm the mouse because I kind of liked it.
Uh-oh.
I mean, I thought this cartoon was at least more Team Cat than the actual cartoons, which I respected. I mean, Jerry here comes across as kind of like a wannabe Instagram influencer who wants something for nothing. And I think there's a bit of a vague theme about Chloe Moretz fighting for a job in the city. You know, we're all kind of living in this, like, dog-eat-dog, cat-eat-mouse capitalism world where there's not enough to go around. I like that they do kind of the 2D-style animation on Tom and Jerry, and that for consistency, all of the animals in the movie are also animated. Like, even when they go to the fish market, all the dead fish are animated. And I think Chloe Moretz is really good in this. Like, she's on the right vibration. But that all said, there's like way too many human subplots at the end. Like, we're supposed to care at the climax about this random couple getting married who we barely know about. And at that point, I was like, who is this movie for? Like, I'm here to watch The Cat and the Mouse. We don't need any of this other stuff.
The PG-rated Tom and Jerry is showing in multiple theaters, including the Paramount Drive-In, the Van Buren Drive-In in Riverside, and the Regency Theater in Laguna Niguel. It's also streaming on HBO Max. More reviews are just ahead on Film Week, including the documentary The Truffle Hunters and the latest SpongeBob movie. We'll be back in just a minute. Welcome back to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. Let's get right back to reviewing the latest releases with our critics Wade Major, Amy Nicholson, and Charles Solomon. Next up is Pixie. It's a crime comedy set in Ireland. It follows a young woman who masterminds a heist to avenge her mother's death. It's directed by Barnaby Thompson and stars Olivia Cooke, Ben Hardy, and Daryl McCormick. Amy?
This is a decent, gory Irish comedy. It's kind of Diet Martin McDonough. So Pixie is played by Olivia Cooke, an actress I really like, and she's this gorgeous, tough, unflappable girl in Ireland that all of the local guys are just obsessed with. They say that she has a reputation for destroying hearts like a Kalashnikov. And at the very start of the movie, we see her kind of placing a bullet on her mother's grave and saying she's going to get out of this town. Well, meanwhile, these two guys who both have a crush on her are robbing a church. And the way that that church robbery plays out, several people wind up dead, her plans to leave get scattered, then two more guys with crushes on her get involved, and then a lot of other people wind up dead, and everybody is just chasing her through Ireland. I mean, including like Alec Baldwin playing this like evil priest. It's flirty, it's fun. There's a lot of bang-bang shooting at the end, which is like, okay, fine, whatever. It dabbles a little bit in sexiness. It moves so fast that I felt like the film didn't quite congeal. At the big finale, I was a little bit let down because it starts stronger than it ends, but this is quite fun.
Wade?
I haven't laughed this hard at so much senseless violence and murder since Fargo. It's probably going to be deemed a minor entry into that genre, that dark, that bloody dark comedy crime genre. Cook just owns this film in every single corner. It's a wonderful performance. It's so much fun. It's dark. Don't get me wrong. It's not for all tastes. But, you know, director Barnaby Thompson, he's a veteran producer, Wayne's World and tons of other movies. And he doesn't make a lot of movies as a director, but his son wrote the script. And it clearly is very clever, and they had a lot of fun with it, and you have a lot of fun watching it.
Pixie is rated R, apparently deservedly so. You can see it at the CineLounge Drive-In in Hollywood and various video-on-demand platforms, including iTunes, Vudu, and Fandango Now. Next up, Boss Level. It's an action take on the Groundhog Day formula. It stars Mel Gibson, Naomi Watts, Frank Grillo, and Will Sasso. Wade, we have seen quite a few of these groundhog-type films lately. Is this worth watching again and again and again?
It absolutely is. Yes, we had Palm Springs, and just a few weeks ago we had The Map of Tiny Perfect Things, which are much closer to Groundhog Day per se. This is basically Groundhog Day meets John Wick. And it's also a lot like Edge of Tomorrow, the Tom Cruise film. There's a bit of Run Lola Run, you know, in here as well. And I'm so happy that Frank Grillo finally gets a great lead role. This is like an 80s action spectacular. He wakes up every day and the same team of ridiculous assassins are trying to kill him. And of course, they wind up killing him pretty much every day. And he can't figure out why he keeps waking up in the same day and everyone's trying to kill him. And eventually he works it out and he figures it out. And it's a little bit like trying to work your way through a video game. But Grillo, who's been, you know, a workaday bad guy and sporting actor for so long, is so much fun in this. He's so good. Mel Gibson is a terrific baddie. He really plays the heavy beautifully. And it's an awful lot of fun.
Boss Level is directed by Joe Carnahan. It's streaming now on Hulu and it's unrated. Okay, enough with the Groundhog Day stuff. Next up, Truffle Hunters. It's a documentary from directors Michael Dweck and Gregory Kershaw. And before we get to the movie, I have to share some facts about truffles. They're not mushrooms. They're tubers. Only 25% of people can actually smell how wonderful they are. Another 35% can't smell them at all. And the remaining 40% think truffles smell like rotten wood, sweat, and urine. So, Amy, wonderful or urine?
Wow. I would go with wonderful, but none of that is in the doc. So thank you for edifying us. I mean, this is a doc that is really beautifully filled, but it's about men and money and nature and men and their dogs. The truffle hunters we hear, they see here, they live in this, you know, old school life of like isolation, where every day they go out with their dog to hunt for truffles by themselves. They don't want anybody else to know their spots. They're trying to get rich, but none of them actually are that rich. And they're even more concerned about money because there's people muscling in on their territory and poisoning their dogs, which becomes like a big fear that drives a lot of the movie. The film is told in these beautiful static shots. It looks a lot like paintings. And it slowly, from these woodland shots, kind of extends to the world, into the middleman who buys the truffles, the man above that guy who buys the truffles from him, the auction customers. And you get out and out in these rings away from the forests, where you realize how far these men are who are doing the work from the actual money, you know, how much they're not earning, and what's going to happen to this entire industry when these men who are all very old die out. I will just say this is not just a beautiful movie, it's a really great one for dog lovers. So if you want to hug your dog and watch a movie, this would be the one.
Yeah, there's some photography where they mount a GoPro camera on a dog as it is truffle hunting, and it's spectacular footage. Charles, what do you think of the film?
Well, as long as we're playing truffle trivia, it's one of the two really important agricultural plants that can't be cultivated, the other being wasabi. The movie struck me as a cross between a geezer comedy and a travel poster. It's, as Amy said, it's beautifully photographed. It makes you want to just run out to Piedmont and tromp through the woods. These characters are a little too determinedly eccentric for my taste, like the man who takes the bath with his dog.
No, with a hair dryer in the bath to dry his dog. Not something you should practice at home.
And it doesn't tell you as much as it should about what's actually going on. Yes, there's the auction that looks something like a cross between a convention and a holy ritual. And it's clear that while these old geezers are bargaining for truffles in the hundreds of euros per 100 kilograms, they're then being sold for thousands of euros per 100 kilogram, et cetera, et cetera. But not nearly as informative as it could and should have been, I think.
Wade?
I concur with everything. The one thing I would add is that by shooting it with a certain kind of artful austerity in order to make them look less eccentric, it winds up making it look a little more like a David Lynch film, which makes all of these guys look more eccentric. So I love truffles. I'm glad these guys are doing what they're doing to fuel my appetite. But the movie itself is a little too fringy for my taste.
I found it very tasty, but, you know, some people don't like truffles. That is the documentary, The Truffle Hunters. It's directed by Michael Dweck and Gregory Kershaw. It's rated PG-13. You can see it at the Vineland Drive-In Theater in the City of Industry. Now, the SpongeBob movie, Sponge on the Run. It's a live-action/computer-animated film. It's directed by the series developer, Tim Hill. Charles, SpongeBob, are you with or not?
Well, I mean, SpongeBob has been with us since 1999. And so if it peaked a while ago, yes, but it still has its followers and its fans. The puzzling thing about this movie is, why did they do it in CG? There's nothing in the animation itself or in the storyline that really uses the possibilities that opens. I've heard from people who are much more into SpongeBob than I am, it's kind of taken from an episode many years ago where Bob's pet snail Gary is snail napped and somebody wants to use him to make skin cream. But it could have been handled just as easily as two or three episodes of the show. So if you're seriously into SpongeBob, it's very, very familiar, but not a lot new here.
What about Keanu Reeves as the sage?
Well, as with Demi Moore, I think no matter what movie you're talking about, you can always say Keanu Reeves has never been better.
The SpongeBob movie Sponge on the Run is out on VOD platforms, including Apple TV, Prime Video, and Vudu. And if you saw any of the 57 Super Bowl commercials for Paramount Plus, you can find it there, too. Next up, FTA. It's a 1972 documentary. It has been re-released in 4K quality. The film follows an anti-Vietnam War roadshow starring a troupe of actors led by Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. Wade?
This is an amazing time capsule, and it's significant because when it was released in 1972, it was only out for 2 weeks before it was pulled from release. I think it's a little unfortunate that it has this new introduction on it from Jane Fonda, where she doesn't really contextualize it properly. She's sort of trying to redeem herself and change the context of the film. The truth is that the film was released literally the same week that she made her infamous trip to Hanoi and was photographed with the North Vietnamese army. And within 2 weeks, Sam Markoff and AIP pulled the film for distribution. So it really hasn't been seen at all. FDA stands for Free the Army, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Most of the original troop members who were significant, Howard Hessman, Peter Boyle, Elliot Gould, Dick Gregory, they didn't join on this trip. But you do get Rita Martinson, who is amazing and whose song, Soldier, We Love You, is the emotional high point of the film. This was kind of a counterweight. They toured the Pacific Rim to sort of counterbalance to Bob Hope's USO tour. It didn't really pull anything close to the same kind of attendance figures, but it was a counterculture answer to that. It was an anti-war response to it, and it captures the era in a really remarkable fashion. So it's a great time capsule and a great historical piece.
The documentary is called FTA. It's directed by Francine Parker. It's rated R. It's available on Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Next up, Chaos Walking. It stars Daisy Ridley, Tom Holland, and Mads Mikkelsen. Christopher Ford and Patrick Ness co-wrote the film, which is based on Ness's novel, The Knife of Never Letting Go. A little background here. This is a $100 million movie that was shot way back in 2017, was supposed to come out a couple of years ago. It reportedly had some $15 million of reshoots, multiple uncredited screenwriters, and another director besides Doug Liman, who are trying to fix it. Lionsgate is hoping it will become its new young adult franchise, replacing The Hunger Games. Amy, any chance of that working out?
Oh, man, no. I mean, you can tell that this is a major film. It's got a major director, major cast. It's based on a major award-winning book trilogy. And it's just a major disaster. It's so sad. It breaks my heart. I mean, this is a film that had such high hopes. Charlie Kaufman did an early draft of the script. The story here is that Tom Holland, you know, we know him as our little Spider-Man. He's the youngest kid living in this all-male rustic primitive village in this New World colony. And everybody in this colony is a man because all of the women have died. Until another woman, who's played by Daisy Ridley, she crash lands on this planet and everybody chases after her and he's chasing after her and he's kind of the person who she befriends. Now, that's sort of the plot, but the really high concept thing about the film is that on this planet, all male thoughts are audible, just like completely audible. Like there's this little purple thing that you see float over everybody's head.
It's kind of a cloud. It's kind of like a cloud of dust, right?
Yeah, it's like a cloud of dust. And then meanwhile, then Tom Holland's like, I'm nervous. Is she looking at me? What's going on? What's happening? And it's just, especially from Tom, because since he's young in this village, he hasn't learned how to control his thoughts, unlike the mayor, Mads Mikkelsen, who can control his thoughts. Now, what's also happening in this movie is that, like, you can't hear women's thoughts, like, only men's thoughts. So it becomes, like, this bad stand-up comedy movie about the genders. Maybe this works in a book, but, like, in a movie, it just feels like it's a story about how men are embarrassing and have no impulse control, and women are, like, aloof and unscrutable. And then they just go on the run. I mean, it's so bonkers that it just doesn't work on film. It makes the idea seem like way more funnier than I think the book is meaning to do. And then it makes the plot just seem so clunky. Like it's trying for all of these highfalutin noble ideas I want to support, but it just feels like a joke.
So the double bill would be Chaos Walking and Mel Gibson's What Women Want. Chaos Walking is directed, if people don't remember that movie, look it up. It's directed by Doug Liman. It's rated PG-13. It's available at various drive-in theaters, including the Paramount Drive-In and the Vineland Drive-In. Now, keep an eye out. It's a French and Belgium co-production. It follows a police unit trying to solve a murder case. It's set in France. It's written and directed by Quentin Dupuis. Wade.
Yeah, I don't know if it's so much about officers trying to solve a murder case. I think it's just sort of it's more like a one-act play between primarily two actors with a few other actors thrown in, set in a police station. And it's essentially a comedic conversation between a guy who may have been a witness and this cop played by Belgian actor Benoît Poulvert. And it goes into all of these weird tangential places that don't make any sense. But you know, Quentin Dupieux is an eccentric filmmaker. Rubber and Deerskin are his previous movies. And he originally started as a DJ known as Oiseau in France. So his movies have kind of a DJ's pacing, and they're never longer than about an hour and 15 minutes. This one's about 73 minutes, and that's about all it really needs to be. It's a hoot. It's not a real meaningful hoot, but it's kind of a fun sit.
Amy?
Yeah, I mean, this is just like a small, strange pleasure. It's unique more than anything else. I mean, I enjoyed it. Like, as the man who sort of felt like he's being pinned maybe for this crime that he did or did not do, as he recounts his evening, you keep like going inside his story, but then its story shifts. There's like interruptions and disruptions and distractions and detours. There's another corpse that's hidden that he knows about that he's getting nervous about. It's a parlor trick of a movie, but I enjoyed it. I watch everything Quentin does just because he has such a strange brain. I want to be inside his brain, and 75 minutes inside this brain is just the right amount.
Much more to come on Film Week, including Boogie. It's a film from Eddie Wong, who is famous for Fresh Off the Boat. We also have my interview with Robin Wright, who directs and stars in the new drama Land. I'm John Horn, sitting in for Larry Mantle. You're listening to Film Week on 89.3 KPCC. We'll be back with more reviews and Robin Wright right after this break. Welcome back to Film Week. I'm John Horn in for Larry Mantle. Let's get back to a very busy week for new releases. We're going to go to Boogie. It's a coming-of-age story about Alfred Boogie Chin. He's a basketball player from Queens. It's written and directed by lawyer turned chef turned author Eddie Wong, who wrote the memoir Fresh Off the Boat, but famously disowned that series, which was based on his book. This is his feature directorial debut, and he plays an uncle in the film who has irritable bowel syndrome. Amy, is that sort of omen?
Yes, let's just call it an omen. Let's just call it an omen. That would make it a little bit more interesting than I think the final film actually is. This is just a standard story of a teenager who's growing into himself, you know, a teenager who's got a teacher telling him to read Catcher in the Rye. It's a very formulaic film, but it's got an interesting setting. We're in the Taiwanese community in Flushing. And when we first meet he's in the womb of his mother. His mother is like at a fortune teller with his dad. They're not married. They're this young pregnant couple. They're asking for advice. And you can tell that his mom doesn't really want to tie the knot or tie herself at all to his dad for good reason. They're very, very different. But when we meet him again, he's like a teenager. His family just doesn't get along. They're always screaming at each other. There's a lot of slapping and arguing in this movie, and they're mostly arguing about what he's going to do with his life. Like, is he going to get to college on a basketball scholarship or not? But the thing is, you know, he's not the greatest student, and he's not even really I wouldn't say he's even the best basketball player, because even though he's really talented, he's like an immature, aggressive ball hog.
He thinks he's the best.
He thinks he's the best ball player, and he's probably the top two. I guess I really wanted to like this movie, but I honestly just found it super tedious. You know, he's got this girlfriend who doesn't really respect anything about him, and we don't really respect anything about him either. Like, their whole relationship is just
irritating. he doesn't respect her at all. Like, the first thing he says to her is like really offensive.
It's terrible. And then she slowly forgives him for that. I don't know. I just felt like this was a very paint by numbers kind of movie. Like, I did not care anything about any of it.
Wade, the bar is low. Amy did not care for anything about it. What about you?
You know, I think everything that has been said, I think everything you've said and Amy has said is true. I'm more forgiving of it because I do find Eddie Wong to be a kind of a fascinating figure. You forgot he's also a clothing designer.
Yes.
You know, he's never been a filmmaker before. So what he's bringing to this is basically his own persona. And that's the persona that Taylor Takahashi represents in the film, which is someone who is Asian, but who's trying to sort of integrate a lot of these street characteristics and cross cultures and merge, you know, certain ethnic behaviors. And Eddie has been criticized for that, but I think he represents kind of a unique perspective on American culture and what it means to be an American and the child of immigrants and to live in a certain community. And from that perspective, I found his point of view interesting. I didn't find the movie or the characters necessarily that bracing, but I did think that his point of view and what he brings to the movie and to the story was compelling.
Boogie stars Taylor Takahashi and Taylor Page. You can see it at the Mission Tiki Drive-In in Montclair. It's rated R. Next up, Gustav Stickley, American Craftsman. This is a documentary about the American furniture designer. If you have a lot of money, maybe you have a Stickley chair or table in your house. Charles?
Well, full confession, I have a rocker and a bookcase and a table, but they're all reproductions.
Oh, they're fake Stickleys.
So, no, not, I mean, reproductions, honestly so. Not, and they weren't palmed off as the genuine article, but I did not know much about Stickley. I learned a fair amount from this film. The problem is it is rather dry, and I wish they had talked to people who weren't either related to him or were serious collectors of his work. There's one couple where it's very clear the husband buys this stuff and loves it, and his wife just puts up with it and sits there and looks at him throughout their discussions. But again, I wish there had been more context for him, and I kept contrasting it with a related subject that was Don Hahn's film a year or two ago about the Gamble House in Pasadena, and how much more I learned from that and how much better it put it in context. But if you want to know a little bit about more about the man who designed such wonderfully well-proportioned furniture, you'll learn from this film.
That is your unvarnished opinion. Gustav Stickley, American Craftsman, is directed by Herb Stratford, is showing at Lemley's Virtual Cinema. Next, continuing a theme of dogs in movies, the documentary Stray, directed by Elizabeth Lowe, follows a stray dog named Zaten living on the streets of Istanbul. Amy.
Yeah, well, you might remember that a few years ago we had the documentary Kedi, which is about the cats of Istanbul, and now we have Stray, which is about the dogs of Istanbul. You might be wondering why we have so many movies about pets in Istanbul, and there's a couple of reasons. I mean, or strays, is because one is because, like, Turkey is one of the only countries that has made it illegal to euthanize stray dogs, and that they really do respect animals running the show on their streets. And you get some great close-up footage in here of, like, a few dogs that you get to know fairly well making their way through town. But really, the other reason, I think, why this documentary is made actually has very little to do with the animals. It's kind of a ruse, because, you see, in Turkey, the Minister of Culture gets to approve whether or not a documentary is even shown. Wow. And so they don't like documentaries about the problems of Turkey. And then it becomes important, realizing in this film, that what you mostly see the dogs do is interacting with people like Kurdish squatters, Chechen and Turkmen immigrants, Syrian refugee children, all the people that Turkey doesn't really want you to make films about. And it becomes this film about, like, using these dogs as a way of talking about how animals in the city are treated with more care and respect than a lot of the humans who are also living on the streets. It's kind of like a mirage of a documentary. Like, look over here. This is what we're pretending this is about. But honestly, it's really about the problems that are happening that Turkey doesn't want to talk about.
Wade?
Yeah, in that respect, it is fascinating. It's not structured like a documentary. It's not even structured like a film, to be honest. And the filmmakers are very, very open about that. They wanted the dogs and the trajectory of their daily sort of random interactions to form the structure of the film. And what I found interesting was the way that it was shot, the way that they were able to sort of follow the dogs. You know, they put GPS collars on them. They'd track them down the next day and pick up where they left off, and they use double-sided microphones to be able to pick up peripheral conversations and, you know, things you couldn't do here because of privacy laws and whatnot. So they were able to make a really interesting tapestry of what's going on in the real Istanbul today, and a lot of it is really quite incendiary. I mean, if you understand the role that dogs play or do not play in Islam, there's a bit during the end titles where a barking dog sort of howls along with the call to prayer from a muezzin coming over the speakers, which is, in a sense, is sort of sacrilegious. So there's a very subversive tenor to the film that I think makes up for the fact that it doesn't really have much of a conventional structure.
Stray is unrated. It's available at Lemley's Virtual Cinema and other select theaters. You can also see it on video on demand platforms like Fandango Now, iTunes, and Google Play. We're going to squeeze in one more movie, Sun. It's a horror thriller. It stars Annie Matichak, Emil Hirsch, and Luke David Blum. Wade, what's your take on Sun?
This is what I typically call a resume piece. Ivan Kavanaugh wrote and directed it. Ivan Kavanaugh is a very capable director, a little bit less of a capable writer. This is just pieces of Rosemary's Baby and The Omen and The Exorcist and a dozen other horror films all packed together. This is about a woman who escaped a cult and thought she and her son, whose origins are a little bit shady, were safe, and then suddenly, you know, the cult may or may not have shown up again and done something to her son, who starts manifesting all kinds of strange cultish behaviors. You know, it doesn't really do anything we haven't seen before. The script is fairly routine and derivative, but as a director, Ivan Kavanaugh does have some flair, so he should get another crack.
So even if Son isn't it, we might be hearing more from him?
I would think so.
Son is directed by Ivan Kavanaugh. It's showing in select theaters, so check your local listings, although make sure it's safe to go. It's also available on video on demand platforms, including iTunes, Fandango Now, and Vudu. Coming up, we have my interview with Robin Wright talking about her film Land. And my thanks to critics Wade Major, Amy Nicholson, and Charles Solomon. Outside of my talk with Robin Wright, thank you for your participation. I'm John Horn, in for Larry Mantle.
Support comes from Ciclavia, catalyzing vibrant public spaces, active transportation, and good health through car-free streets. Ciclavia promotes respect and infrastructure for bike and pedestrian-friendly public spaces. Enjoy these pop-up parks for the day in your favorite people-powered way. Jogging, biking, skating, strolling, or simply spectating. Free and open to all, Ciclavia Sundays generate miles of smiles in neighborhoods all over L.A. Details at www.ciclavia.org.